Russia says it's taken over two towns in the southeast of Ukraine on the fifth day of its military operation in the neighboring country. Ukrainian president calls for the immediate accession of his country to the European Union a day after the bloc agreed on military aid to Kiev. Iran says European countries and the U.S. have yet to make political decisions on major issues in the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Live from Tehran, this is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, fighting raging across Ukraine as Russian military offensive enters its fifth day. Both sides are making claims of gains on the ground. Russian Defense Ministry says its forces have taken over two small cities in southeastern Ukraine and the area around the nuclear power plant. It says the plant's operations are continuing normally. Ukraine has denied that the nuclear plant has fallen into Russian hands. Fighting was also reported around the southeastern port city of Mariupol throughout the night. Ukrainian authorities said that blasts were also heard before dawn in the capital of Kiev and the major eastern city of Kharkiv. They stressed that Russian ground forces' attempts to capture major urban centers have been repelled.
The Russian occupiers have slowed down the offensive, but are still trying to build on success in some areas in the offensive against Ukraine. During the air offensive, the enemy continued to fire on military and civilian airfields, military control points, air defense facilities, important critical infrastructure, settlements, and units in defense areas.
The Ukrainian military also accused Russia of launching a missile strike on residential buildings in two cities in the country's northwest and north. The UN Human Rights Chief says that at least 102 civilians in Ukraine have been killed since Thursday, with a further 304 wounded. Michelle Bachelet, however, warned that the real figures fear to be considerably higher. Ukraine says that some 4,500 Russian forces have been killed during the past 5 days of fighting. Russia has not provided any update on that figure. Meantime, Ukraine and Russia have started negotiations at the border with Belarus. The Ukrainian presidency says the delegation includes the country's defense minister and a presidential advisor. A Russian negotiator says Moscow wants to reach an agreement with Ukraine. Ukrainian President Zelensky also says he will use every opportunity to secure peace. He, however, says he is skeptical that negotiations will bear any fruit.
Alexander Lukashenko called for a meeting of the Ukrainian and Russian delegations. I emphasize, without any conditions. I'll say frankly, as always, I do not really believe in the outcome of this meeting, but let him try, so that later not a single citizen of Ukraine has any doubt that I, as president, try to stop the war when there was even a small but still a chance.
Zelensky urged fellow citizens to defend their country. He also asked the European Union to immediately grant membership to Ukraine under a special procedure. Zelensky says that the goal of the move is to be with all the Europeans and, most importantly, to be equal with the bloc's member states. On Sunday, the European Union agreed to give military aid to Kiev to stand against Russia. Okay, now from Brussels, let's bring in Jerome Hughes, our correspondent there, and let's see what he has for us. Jerome, so Europe is showing some reaction to this Russian operation in Ukraine, and now Ukraine is also asking for a quick membership.
Yes, Behrouz, and you know, in a way, it's quite farcical because it takes many, many years for a country to join the European Union. Obviously, it's clear that it has been an ambition of Ukraine's to become a member and to become the 28th member now. But as I say, it takes a long time, and it's met a lot of stumbling blocks down through the years, but also as recently as 5 months ago, when the European Court of Auditors, which is the financial watchdog for the EU, declared that the money that has been spent by Brussels to try and bring Kiev up to speed to meet the standards of accession, that that has failed miserably because the money has been wasted. It's been squandered, the 17 billion euro, because the European Court of Auditors says that corruption is still rife at the highest levels. So it doesn't meet the criteria. And I mean, if you look at other countries, for example, Albania, which is already a member of NATO, it has more or less met the criteria to join the EU, but that, for political reasons, has been blocked up to now by France and Netherlands. So, you know, the idea, this sort of smacks of desperation, it feels, from Zelensky to say, look, just bring us in, you know, in the midst of a war. It just seems farcical. But, you know, anything seems to be able to be, when you have a situation that yesterday, Sunday, the EU took a decision to basically throw away its handbook and change its policies and, for the first time, get directly involved as a bloc in a conflict by arming the Ukrainian forces against Russia, with including fighter jets. So it's an incredible escalation, and we're really concerned to wait and see how Russia might respond, because not only do you have these very tough sanctions, financial sanctions, but now you have the EU arming Ukraine. Now, of course, you know, the United States and the UK and EU countries individually were already sending arms to Ukraine, but the fact that the EU as a bloc has decided to do this certainly is a departure from the norms. And actually, you know, meetings are happening at the last minute. They're being organized at the last minute. This morning, Monday morning, a meeting of EU defense ministers was called. It's going to be a virtual meeting online, chaired by the foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell. So we'll get more details later on today at the press conference in relation to how this looks in terms of this military hardware going to Ukraine. I'd also to mention as well that there will be a full day, full hearing all day tomorrow in the European Parliament. EU lawmakers will debate the decisions that have been taken up to now, and they will take a series of votes. Now, it's likely that the votes will pass, but there will be a sizable number of lawmakers who will make the point that what the European Union is doing is actually making a bad situation worse by this sort of really harsh anti-Russia rhetoric at a time when tensions are already very high, and also this element of sending military equipment into Ukraine. So it'll be very interesting to see how the proceedings in the European Parliament pan out tomorrow.
Okay, so you'll be watching that, and we'll be coming back to you for an update later on. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels. Now, President Vladimir Putin's decision to put Russia's nuclear weapons on high alert has drawn mixed reactions from Western officials. Some are playing it down as a diversion. Others are warning of a potentially ominous escalation. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says that the move is part of a pattern of the Russian leader's behavior to fabricate threats justifying further aggression. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. says that Putin's actions are unnecessarily escalatory and totally unacceptable. A Pentagon official also warned that the move could put in play forces that would make things much more dangerous in case of a miscalculation. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, meantime, says that the announcement is a distraction from what's really happening in Ukraine and the resistance Russia is facing there. Putin on Sunday cited aggressive statements by leading NATO powers and unfriendly economic actions by Western countries for his decision. The Russian military attack against Ukraine is forcing many Ukrainians to leave their homes for other countries in search of safety. The reception of the refugees has been commended by many, but has also highlighted the deep-rooted bias and at times outright racism at the heart of some Western capitals. Some 420,000 Ukrainians have crossed into the EU since the beginning of the offensive on Thursday. They are warmly welcomed by leaders of countries like Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, Moldova, and Romania. The hospitality, however, stands in sharp contrast to the treatment given to refugees from West Asia and Africa in recent years, particularly Syrians fleeing the crisis in their country. Recent comments by the Bulgarian president are a perfect manifestation of the discrepancy. Roman Radev describes the Ukrainian refugees as intelligent, educated people, as opposed to the non-European refugees the country is used to receiving, which he deems as potential terrorists. A Syrian journalist, himself a refugee, slammed the behavior as a mix of racism and Islamophobia. Such racist views are also sweeping through Western airwaves. A CBS reporter attracted heavy criticism and was forced to apologize after comparing Kiev with Afghan and Iraqi cities, saying that the Ukrainian capital was relatively civilized and relatively European. Now, Iran says a draft agreement has been prepared following negotiations in Vienna aimed at reviving the 2015 landmark accord, but the West has yet to adopt a political decision for a final deal. Belarus. There is this draft of an agreement that's prepared, so that draft needs to be studied and scrutinized carefully. There are a number of issues left. So there were certain instructions that Dr. Bagri needs to have in order to be able to negotiate with the other side. In the three, let's say, major sticking points, they're still, you know, the Western side and the U.S., they still have not adopted the political decision. The official says that Iran has raised the red lines during negotiations, the logic behind them, and how those issues could be addressed. The spokesman says that Iran won't refrain from the red lines, won't actually do away with them, and that sanctions removal and enrichment are still among issues that have to be resolved. He blamed Washington for the status quo, saying that the U.S. has to give concrete guarantees with regard to its commitments under the deal. Khatibzadeh said that Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal are there at the talks to come up with a more durable agreement. He said that the Islamic Republic will not do anything beyond the 2015 agreement. Okay, now, speaking of the Vienna talks, let's go to Vienna, to the venue of the talks. Hamal Lesgi, our correspondent, is there. Hamal, good to have you with us. So we have this draft agreement, and the official Iran official is back in the capital city to look into this carefully and meticulously, as the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman put it this morning. So the draft agreement is there. It needs finalization. There are also a few points, stumbling blocks that remain. Tell us more about these.
Yes, that's right. So the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Bagheri Kani, is back in Vienna. Members of his team were here and have been involved in various informal meetings, consultations with the other participants to work on those remaining issues. As you just mentioned there in the news, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman confirming that indeed the draft of the final agreement is ready, but there are still some serious issues that remain to be resolved. Now, what we're hearing from sources close at least to the Iranians is that if the Europeans, the three European signatories, Britain, France, Germany, and the US continue, in the words of these sources, with their unacceptable approach, and if they do not get serious when it comes to dealing with these issues, then we are going to have an impasse. But if they take serious action and make those decisions, then we will be able to have a deal. So it's basically, we could call it a make or break situation right now. At the same time, Iranians have been saying that they are not committed to any deadlines, and any talk by various sources, especially coming from the Western side of, for instance, the end of February or early March, as a deadline, at a time when these negotiations will have to end. This is not something that the Iranians see themselves committed to, and they have never said that they are committed to any deadline. What they want, they say, is to get these remaining issues resolved, because if they do not get resolved, then they will not agree to this draft, to this basically revived JCPOA. So yesterday there was a meeting here in Vienna between the other participants and the U.S., and the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, said that everybody's waiting now for the return of the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Bagheri, to be able to, in his words, finalize a deal. Now, what are sources close to the Americans saying up until this point? Senior State Department officials confirming that indeed significant progress has been made in the past week or so, and that they are moving towards a final deal. But also they've suggested that it's important at the same time to note that there are still serious issues that remain. And one of these issues, of course, we know from various sources, from various news outlets, is the issue of credible guarantees. That is still supposedly one of the stumbling blocks. Iran wanting guarantees that it can rely on, that the U.S. will not withdraw again, will not violate the deal again. And also another issue reportedly still not resolved is all of the sanctions that Iran wants removed. So we'll have to see if these remaining issues can be resolved, how long it will take, if we are indeed going to reach a deal. A lot of sources are expecting a decision to be announced very soon, maybe in a week's time. But, of course, things are quite predictable, as you know, in these kinds of talks.
All right, thanks for that, Hamal Lesgi, our correspondent in Vienna. Now, moving on, the Yemeni army says it's downed the spy aircraft belonging to the Saudi-led coalition in the country's northwest. Army spokesman says that a U.S.-made Scan Eagle drone was downed in the Hajjah province. The Saudi-led coalition has recently intensified attacks on Yemen, targeting civilian infrastructure, including telecom stations. The Yemeni army has in turn ramped up cross-border raids. Sana says it will continue the operations until the aggressors end the war and lift the blockade of Yemen. Now, elsewhere in the region, public universities across Afghanistan have reopened after a closure of nearly 7 months. Boys and girls have gone back to classes. Our correspondent has a report from Kabul.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they are happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and changes are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain whether the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban takeover. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Economic Divide.
The truckers' protests in Canada have subsided for the most part, but it was a costly one. Hundreds of millions of dollars lost. But since it disrupted a cross-border shipping route, the bigger question comes about what other supply chain disruptions are taking place. Hi, I'm Kavita Vahi, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at the Canada protests, then supply chain disruptions, which are struggling to get back to normal. Coming up in today's programs, Canada rocked by weeks of anti-COVID protests morphing into anti-government protests, Freedom Convoy protests impacted cross-border trade and has spread to other parts of the world. Next, we're taking a look at the Canada protests and the impact they've had on how it blocked the workflow and transit routes with severe negative impact on supply chains. The chaos at ports, warehouses, and retailers was one of the consequences of that. Then, cheap and reliable shipping, a thing of the past. Lean warehouses and online systems that monitored inventory may need to revert to a more prudent focus on extra capacity or to expand warehouses to cut down delivery time and costs.
Canada has been rocked by weeks of anti-government protests. The Freedom Convoy protests were started by Canadian truckers against COVID-19 restrictions, but they have had a huge negative economic impact on cross-border trade and business between the U.S. and Canada. Protesters blocked the Ambassador Bridge, which connects both countries. It spans 1.5 miles long and carries more than 40,000 commuters, tourists, and truck drivers every day. The protests have hindered, slowed down, and blocked the workflow, with severe negative impact on supply chains. An estimate published by Anderson Economic Group says between February 7 to February 15, the protests caused $144.9 million in direct wage loss.
So we're seeing a blockade at the Ambassador Bridge on the Canadian side, made up of about 30 pickup trucks and one small SUV. And not truckers, people who are anti-government, whose only express demand right now is for the Prime Minister to resign, who have blocked the most important trade link between the two most integrated partners in the G7.
Most of that loss occurred in the U.S. state of Michigan and Ontario province in Canada. Automakers including GM, Ford, Chrysler, Honda, and Toyota lost a total of $155 million. When all factors are considered, it is estimated that the auto industry lost a total of almost $300 million for that two-week time period. The blocked route sees the import of steel, aluminum, and other parts crucial to the Michigan-based auto industry.
About $300 million worth of goods goes over that bridge every day, and now for the second day, nothing is going. In the automotive business, about $100 million worth of parts go, 50 from one side and 50 from the other side. They're part of a just-in-time principle of automotive manufacturing. And so what's happening is because the parts can't make it across or back, all of the automotive production plants in the region, that's Ontario and Michigan, have shut down today. That is about 100,000, 150,000 jobs on either side of the...
About 40% of what crosses the bridge includes automotive parts and equipment and machinery and electrical equipment. Vehicles are Canada's second largest export, with the U.S. buying more than 90% of that supply. The closure of the bridge has affected an estimated $392 million a day in cross-border transactions. It is estimated that $3 billion to $6 billion in goods did not cross the border last week. Trade between Canada and the U.S. is valued to be at more than $700 billion.
The social media posts on this matter were a lot, especially on the truckers' protests in Canada, in which Justin Trudeau became the focus, jeopardizing democracy as opposed to the supply chain crisis. Now here he is giving his explanation on what he has called the truckers' blockade. The ongoing blockades and occupations are illegal. They are a threat to our economy, supply chains, and trade. They're a threat to public safety. And most importantly, they're a threat to communities, businesses, jobs, and people. They need to end. But what became known as the Freedom Convoy protest may have another agenda other than just protests against vaccine mandates. The Freedom Convoy was organized by Tamara Litch, secretary of the relatively new Maverick Party, a right-of-center group that was started to promote the separation of Canada's three western prairie provinces from the rest of the country. Now, she was later arrested, as seen here by Canadian police. This post caught our attention since it points to the reason there is an inflation problem, in which this post says Obama's former economic advisor, Steve Rattner, has said that Biden is wrong to blame the supply chain crisis for inflation. Again, the former economic advisor to the former President Barack Obama in the op-ed in New York Times. It says Biden keeps blaming the supply chain for inflation. That is dishonest. He believes the bulk of our supply problems are the product of an overstimulated economy. He also says that there has also been an unforeseen shift in what people are buying to durables like cars, electronics, and building materials for housing, for which production and distribution capacity is limited. All right, there were some online social media posts. Well, joining us in this segment of our Q&A is Dust James. Dust James is a truck driver from rural North Carolina. He is a member of the Center for Political Innovation, and he's also a host of Anti-Imperialist America, who joins us. Dust James, welcome to Canada Truck Protest. You're familiar with them. They have hit an economic nerve, obviously, when it comes to Canada in terms of the losses that incurred as a result of it. About $400 million a day in cross-border transactions were lost. How much of a hit did the Canadian economy take from this? And doesn't this show actually a vulnerability when it comes to cross-border trade?
Yes, that's a very good question. I think I would respond with, would you fault a striking fast food worker who refuses to work for less than minimum wage with your inability to purchase a cheap hamburger? And the answer is no. When workers find conditions intolerable, conditions like forced medical procedures to continue their employment, that is not the fault of the worker. That is the fault of those increasingly tyrannical governments with growing police states.
All right, let's find out what Larry Frist thinks. Larry Frist is the adjunct professor of economics at Utah Valley University. He's also a host at Red State Talk Radio, who joins us. Larry Frist, welcome. The Canadian Freedom Convoy protest is the name brought to light the supply chain crisis in some respects. In this case, it was a cross-border trade where is part of the supply chain for that particular industry, which involved automobiles for the most part. Now, much of the focus has been with the supply chain crisis on ports, warehouses, and also retailers. It is set to persist throughout the year. What supply chain links are leading to the chaos, in your opinion?
Hello. So the supply chain issue really is much bigger than this. And let me kind of rehearse part of it. Supply chain issues with China being the largest manufacturer begins in China. We don't have real reports, although some reports on the ground indicate that there was a much larger impact of COVID on Chinese manufacturing and factories themselves. As a result, there were shorter shifts. In some cases, there were factories that were closed. And so that meant that production was significantly reduced starting at the point of origin.
Our Infinite section is here where we cover economic news from around the world. Now this time we need to start with something that is happening in one of our neighboring countries. That country is Syria. The economy there is battered and many are barely scraping by, if at all. A Syrian public sector employee said that prices were much cheaper during the war. Her monthly allowance, as she said, 30,000 Syrian pounds, was worth only around $150 at that time, but today it amounts to $6. And while we are on purchasing power, things don't look that rosy for some Western countries also. In this case, France. Seems like up to 80% think purchasing power is decreasing in that country. Mainly, they attribute it to the surging prices of basic goods and energy costs. So obviously there, they are a victim of inflation, as many countries around the world are experiencing the same, hence a decrease in purchasing power. Now, we have covered this topic before. It's about COVID billionaires, but we wanted to revisit it because it just sounds unfair, The rate at which the wealth of the super rich keeps increasing, while the poor at the same time are getting poorer. But the middle class, they're the ones that are also getting squeezed. But aside from that, in this case, we looked at the situation in the U.S. Of how the billionaires' wealth increased during the pandemic. You ask, how big an increase did the wealthy experience there? Well, this is it.
99% of humanity is being left behind. So as we've watched billionaire growth double at the rate of $15,000 per second, that's the same $80 less per second than a minimum wage worker makes in a year.
And finally, let's move on to Credit Suisse. Shame on you, Credit Suisse. Why? This investment banking company ignored murders while laundering cocaine cash. Well, that's according to a former employee who said management knew about murders, knew about cocaine smuggling connected to a Bulgarian gang. Hence, it continued managing cash that is now at the center of a criminal trial. If there are any topics that you'd like for us to cover in your part of the world, please let us know. We would definitely look at your recommendations or write to us. If you just want to drop us a line, that's okay also.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
When it comes to the supply chain crisis, there are many factors at play that lead to the creation of bottlenecks, and that is what we're going to be looking at in this in-depth section. First, let's take a look at the chain itself because it is noteworthy to see the major access points. Well, it all begins with raw materials. Things like steel, oil, corn, grain, or gasoline. Obviously, an important starting point starts from there. Next up, suppliers. Suppliers are a person or business that provides a product or service to another entity. They provide goods to manufacturers in rather large quantities. Next up, the manufacturer. That's a company that produces finished goods from the raw materials by using various tools, equipment, and processes. Then comes the distributor. In order for that, for the goods to reach the consumer, that is, they play a very important role because it's the only entity that distributes goods in a specific area. After that comes the retailer. The retailer is a business that sells the goods to the public in small quantities for use or consumption. And then finally, people like me and you, the consumer. That's right. Consumer is the one who purchases goods and services for personal use. So wrap up of the parts or the access points we thought were important are listed down here. There were five of them: raw materials, suppliers, manufacturer, distributor, and retailer. Now, when it comes to the supply chain crisis itself, how badly were businesses actually affected? Well, according to this source, we're looking at 94% of Fortune 1,000 companies. That's a lot. And to put that into perspective, 75% of supply chains globally were actually affected. Let's put that into context in terms of timing. This graph shows the impact on the time span for the goods to be delivered. We're looking at four different areas: the Eurozone, US, China, and the emerging markets. The blue line here is the Eurozone. We can see that is most affected. Next was the US. This particular line over here, which is the second most affected area, and then, of course, China and the emerging markets. The way we looked at this is with 100, that number, to equal the most disrupted, and it's pretty clear, as you just saw there, that Europe was most affected. Now, let's take a look at here, the EU and supply chain in particular, since we said they're the ones that were most affected. You can see from the year 2010, pretty much a moderate, and they fluctuated between 40 and 50, roughly. But then when you come to the year, obviously 2020 is where you see the drop there. And in terms of the way that we looked at this, manufacturing PMI, suppliers' delivery times, is how this was listed and then pinpointed. And based on the note made by PMI, the readings above 50 indicate faster delivery times. Readings at 50 signal no change, and the readings below 50 indicates lower. So if you go to 50, obviously the downfall there, or the dip that it takes there, the negative point, is between the years 2020 and 2021, of which you can see European Union and the United States. So you get an idea of how bad they were hit there. Let's move on now to get an idea from this case, factory owner. We figured that's a good place to start. In particular, we looked at the owner in Germany, who paints a picture of how vast a problem the supply chain disruption was for his business in Germany. Don't forget, Germany is a European powerhouse, but obviously they've been hit by the supply chain crisis. So from the factory owner to average everyday people who are paying the price on two fronts, either not having their product on the supermarket shelf or paying a higher price as a result of inflation. This particular person, however, an everyday person, knows quite a bit about the supply chain and the crisis that it's involved in.
But I think it's due to that disruption to the supply chains, because some factories need to let people get kind of well, take sick time off to recover from COVID. Maybe that means there's less people working in factories at the same time. And then there's just not enough output. I think also access to like raw materials was mentioned. I saw that on the news as well, that it's one of the reasons. It's just harder to produce things, and probably distribution is also worse. So some produce might get wasted before it even gets to the customers.
Okay, you heard from an everyday person there. All right, let's figure out some analysis into all of these different scenarios. Joining us here is Dust James. He's a truck driver from rural North Carolina who rejoins us. Dust James, welcome back. Taking a look at the Canada truck protests to have hit in obviously the crisis that caused in terms of the cross-border trade between the U.S. and Canada. But we're also looking at how it brought into light the supply chain crisis. Much of it is focused when it comes to supply chain crisis at ports, warehouses, and retailers. What supply chain links are leading to the chaos, in your opinion?
Yes, that's another good question. And I can come back with a bit of an anecdotal response, but I leave to be representative of the larger system. I'm a truck driver. I've driven all 48 states. I've driven in Canada. Recently, I took a local job delivering snacks and food to local convenience stores. And that has been the model of business for convenience stores. There is a small regional distributor that gets those snacks and foods to those convenience stores.
Okay, Larry Friss is an adjunct professor of economics. He rejoins us to tell us what he thinks. Larry Friss, taking a look at major brands, traditionally they're shipped from factories around the world and also obviously from the warehouses that supply retail outlets, e-commerce demands, etc. Retailers must deliver individual orders to homes and businesses. How much of a problem is this lack of warehouses? Is it as big as they have made it out to be?
Hello. The warehouse issue is really one that is not as it may have been reported, and I'll tell you why. Warehouses were largely emptied as supplies were distributed to various retailers across the country. And so those warehouses are largely available to receive goods for further distribution. The problem is that they're not getting product as quickly as they normally would.
The blockades in Canada, which spread to the U.S., New Zealand, Australia, and France, have highlighted the vulnerability of the global economy to disruptions in supply chains, which were primarily triggered after the outbreak of COVID-19 pandemic. For example, the cost of using those shipping containers between Canada and the U.S. has yet to return to pre-pandemic levels. Freight costs are likely to remain high into late 2022. The growing container costs are increasing the prices of goods. In the U.S., there's a shortage of dock workers to unload the ships and a shortage of truck drivers to pick up the cargo once it has finally unloaded.
And I will say we are working it day and night, 7 days a week, you know, my team, the White House, Secretary Buttigieg's team, and we're starting to see incremental improvement. As my friend Jim Cramer and I talk all the time about semiconductors, there's a lot of work left to do, and so we are on it. We're putting focus on it. We're making slow improvement, But there's no denying that it's a problem. I think we're going to be feeling these effects for well into 2022. And it is disruptive. And that's why we have to stay focused.
According to analysts, the U.S. and the EU are the most exposed to supply chain disruptions. It is widely believed that solving the crisis will need more ships, additional warehouses, and an influx of truck drivers. But none of that can be solved easily. Many months, and perhaps even more than a year, are likely to transpire before the chaos subsides.
Did you ever wonder why China is called the factory of the world? Let's look at the different ways that China can be given that title. Many companies worldwide have heavy dependence on Chinese factories, since China offers a combination of supply chains and a growing middle class that fuels high demand for almost any good. According to a United Nations report, China is home to almost every industry. That is quite an incredible feat if you think about it. But propping up a factory or company is not the end of the story. Chinese companies offer almost the full range of products and services in each of these industries. There needs to be a differentiation made here when it's said that China is home to almost every industry. Although China may produce or manufacture every product on the planet or close to it, it does not mean that it is supplying the whole world with its products. We will refer to stats from before the pandemic, the year 2019 for this data. According to the United Nations Statistics Division, China accounted for 28.7% of global manufacturing output. It is pretty obvious that China leads the pack by a large margin, especially the US leading it by roughly 12%. So why are we mentioning China's superior capacity in being a manufacturing and production hub of the world? Well, because the supply chain bottleneck was in part due to the reliance that many countries around the world have on China. The real surprise came as to where the bottleneck was occurring in the supply chain crisis: ports in other major parts of the world. And when it comes to looking at turnaround times, Asian countries have the lead, with China at number one, while the US and UK are at the bottom of the list, spending an average 50 to 51 days at the ports in the year 2021. And that does it for this segment. I'm Mahdi. Until next episode.
The protests in Canada brought to light one important issue: cross-border trade and how it can be targeted, preventing trade and thus incurring losses. At the same time, it pointed out to the bigger problem that exists, and that is the vulnerability of the supply chain access points. If one is offline, then are there enough alternatives in place so that the flow continues? And as far as China goes, it rose to the challenge and made sure that it maintained its top spot as the top manufacturer of the world. Now, given the fact that there are so many countries that buy from China, obviously, the saying goes, when China sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. But I think it prevented that for the time being. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you. From Yikove Tahwei, it's goodbye.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Allah.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are looking at human rights, and specifically justice being the core of human rights. And we are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Now, previously we mentioned that Amir al-Mu'mineen, he constantly emphasized on the fact that people need to raise their concerns and speak out their minds and show their displeasure with their kings and rulers and ruling powers and governments and kings and presidents to show that they are not content, not happy, their rights are not being given to them. So in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen, being annoyed at a cruelty and oppression was in fact an important thing. It's not just a secondary or a recommended action or act. In fact, it's vital that we rise up. And especially when it comes to, you know, welcoming, if we want to welcome equity and justice, it is an important thing to have, to be awake, to be aware, to fight, to realize where we are. And most of the times, at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen and even at our time, we are living as what we refer to in the Matrix, as we have seen in the movie, that people are just turned into batteries. People are turned into machines. They just, you know, the kings and the rulers and the governments, they're just taking everything from us and not giving us anything back. And we are under a sleeping pill. We need to wake up. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he said, no, oppression and cruelty is something that people need to be annoyed with. They need to express their minds and they need to speak out. In return, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he respected the personal freedom of the individuals, and also kept in his view the right of the nation, which is ultimately that's what it should be, that leaders and rulers, that's what they should do. This is what Amir al-Mu'mineen, he himself did, respected the personal freedom of the individuals and kept the rights of the nation. That's what we need from these leaders and rulers and presidents. We need them to give us our freedoms and also the rights of the nations. Now, if you look at a comparison between the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen and what happened to him and now, you can draw the conclusion as well. As regards to those who did not give or did not take the oath of allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen, he said to them clearly and plainly, it does not matter if they do not take the oath of allegiance. I don't care if they don't take it. If they don't want to give it to me, by all means. But in return, however, he said, however, they should stay indoors and should not interfere in the affairs of the nation. That sometimes you see people said, oh, you know what, I don't want to vote, I don't want to elect, I don't want to do anything. By all means, you have the right. But don't come later on and criticize and speak about the governments that took power that you were not part of making. That's a very crucial point. Now, before we go any further, let us take a break and then we will continue.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So just before the break, we said that Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he assumed Khilafah and leadership, he made a statement. He said, people who do not want to give oath of allegiance, by all means, in return, they should not interfere with me when I try to establish justice and try to give people their rights. Now, I said we can draw the conclusion between Amir al-Mu'mineen's time and our time, that we see that today, when we go to elections and we elect the governments and the presidents and prime ministers and the cabinets and ministers, we elect them. Some of us, some we say, well, I don't want to elect, I don't care about this. But once these people become in power and they become oppressors and what have you, you saw those who outcasted themselves, those who stayed away from being involved in the system, they are the ones who are talking and criticizing and what have you. All we get to say to them is, the same thing Amir al-Mu'mineen did, since he did not take part into shaping your freedom and the freedom of people, you should stay away from it. Give you examples. One of the people that did not give allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen was Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, who was a member of the consultative council who denied to take an oath of allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, did not compel him, did not force him to take the oath, and he let him free. I mean, as we know, this is the justice of Ali alayhi as-salam. Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, in return, he said, you do not need to feel worried about me. I shall never rise against you, which is obviously a very fair statement, and this is what was required of him. Amir al-Mu'mineen said, I will not force anyone, but don't you dare come and raise against me once, or rise against me when I assume position. So that was one of the characters that happened. Also, we have Abdullah ibn Umar, the son of Umar himself. He also did not take allegiance and did not give the oath to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam asked him to produce a guarantor who should guarantee that he would not create any disturbance. But Abdullah ibn Umar declined to do so. Thereupon, Amir al-Mu'mineen said to him, you have been ill-mannered since your childhood, and I know you from the very first day. Well, obviously, Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he knew him before he was born. And so he said to him, you need to bring a guarantor to guarantee that you're not going to create any mischief. Abdullah ibn Umar denied that, which means, no, I will do as I please, and I still won't give you my allegiance, which was going against the Khalifa of his time. The Amir al-Mu'mineen said to him, well, what can I say to you? You this is how you were from day one. You were an ill-mannered child. And then the Amir al-Mu'mineen said, salamullah alayhi, he said to him, leave him as well. I guarantee that he will not create any disturbance. Now, what else can Amir al-Mu'mineen do? And people wanted to say, well, okay, let's do something about him. He says, no, leave him be. I will become his guarantor. So the idea is, when it comes to justice, you need to be involved. If you don't want to be involved, don't come again or later and rise against those who are trying to apply it. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.